Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Mike from a New Beginning Group in Neptune, New Jersey.
Hey, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is a Design for Living from from Neptune. And we were joking about that earlier. He was running around rehearsing it, and he messed it up. but he got my name right. Everybody else is calling me John. I also have another home group. I keep two home groups because I have a big – my Design for Living is a big book study group. If you're ever out there, it's on Sundays at 7 o'clock, and it's a great group, and it takes – you know, week by week we go through the book. And it's a great home group, but it's like preaching to the choir. Everybody in there has got sponsees and sponsors and sponsees who have sponsees. And I keep another home group because I find a lot more people to work with in that home group. So I also have another home group on Sunday mornings. It's called Wisdom Off the Wall. And I get more prospects in that group. People don't stumble into the Sunday night group by accident. You know, they usually wind up there after they've struggled in AA for a while and found out that they still weren't comfortable. I have sponsors. His name is Jimmy A. I have sponsees. They have sponsees. My sober date is September 1, 1985. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like and what it was like in recovery and then what it's been like the last few years. Unfortunately, you know, what happens in recovery after being around for a while, you get to make mistakes in recovery. You know, you get rocketed to the fourth dimension, and then all of a sudden when you stop doing the things that rocket you, you know, all of a sudden you hit the ground hard, you know, and you have to get back into the work, and you have to get back, you know, get with a new sponsor and get with a new experience. And I've had to do that a few times because our nature as alcoholics is that we get lazy. We get real comfortable, we start feeling real good, and we stop doing the things that helped us feel real good and get real comfortable. And then until things get uncomfortable enough, and get, you know, just a little twisted enough, and then we, you know what, I need to have a new experience, and you need to get on, and so that's been kind of my story up until about 7 years ago when I met a man who changed my life. So I know, I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, what it was like growing up, and I can tell you Lisa took a ride up with me. I want to embarrass her. Can you stand up and say hello to everybody? Lisa and I were in a relationship for about a year, and that was about a year ago, and we're still friends, and she still like co-piloted the trip up here and stuff with me. That says a real, real lot about me. She knew me when I was growing up, and stayed far away from me when I was growing up, and she knew me since I think when we were about 17 or 16 years old, and. I think we started dating like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever the time was, and we went out for like a year. And she wasn't in this fellowship when we started going out, and I didn't ask her to come in this fellowship. And somehow by being around recovery, by being around stability, by being around some serenity, she wound up wanting to be in this fellowship, you know, and being a part of this fellowship. And she said something to me on the way up here, which was just really beautiful, was she said that I never shoved it down her throat. Like, I never asked her to join the fellowship, and I never said, you should be doing this or you should be doing anything. And all of a sudden, she just kind of, you know, more attraction rather than promotion. You know, whatever you want to say. But, you know, she saw something that she wanted. Right? So, to me, that's a beautiful thing. Okay, so here's the deal. I was 11 years old. When I started this mess, and honestly, the first thing I put in my body was not alcohol because just it was easier to get other things than alcohol when you were this big. You know, I saw my son playing baseball when he was 11 years old, and that summer, and he was so innocent. I mean, he had SpongeBob SquarePants underwear on underneath like his baseball suit, and I remember looking at him. I was up the tracks with a six-pack of Colt 45 and a bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine, the same age that he was the same summer. I couldn't even see how – he was a baby, you know, and I couldn't – it didn't feel like it at the time, but I was a baby, you know, and we start – most of us, that happens to us. We're so young, and so we don't even know what we're doing, and we start doing it, you know, and then all of a sudden we wake up on the other end. You know, for me, I was 28 years old, If I live to be 150, I'm never going to feel as old as I did when I was 28 years old, because I was walking dead. And I remember I was about to go into my first facility, my job. I had lost the job. I got to go through the identification thing. I had lost the job. I had lost the wife with my daughter, because I found a girl who was like a good girl, so I married her so she could help me sober up, you know, and she couldn't help me sober up. And so we decided to have a baby, and that would help me sober up, and that didn't help me sober up. And so she took the baby and left, which was the smart thing to do. Eventually, I guess, that was kind of what motivated me to want to get well. But I had lost a job, and people around me were dying, and I had DWIs and other criminal things that we do. And I was about to lose my second job, and they put me in the facility. And it's a funny story, because it was, I was a computer operator on Wall Street, and I worked the second shift. And before work, I would start my partying, right? And then on break, and then on lunch. And by the end of the night, I was ripped every night, you know. And I'm running the computers, and they kind of run themselves. You put the things up there, and they would, you know. But we had a softball team on Sunday, on Saturday mornings at 8 o'clock on Saturday mornings we played. And, you know, for me, that was like just really late Friday night. Like, it was really... I really didn't even get no sleep. I just kind of went, I got to go play softball, you know. And went home and like took off my little pants and put on my baseball uniform, right, and went down to the field, you know, and kept doing what I was doing. Like, so I'm like center field. I'm like really quick, and I'm, you know, and all of a sudden balls are like bouncing off of me, you know, and you know the leadoff batter is like stumbling over second base and stuff. So I get called into the office on Monday morning, and he says, you need help, because you can't even play center field anymore. And like, that was how my job wound up putting me, you know, in my first facility, basically because I was messing up the softball team. It had little to do with my work. They could care less what I was doing on second shift, you know. But you know, they were a little bit ahead of their time. The first job that I had just fired me. You know, they kind of told me, don't keep doing what you're doing. Because second shift computer operator was like a great job for a drunk. You can go out, you know, you can put the computer tapes on, go out, get some, you know, hang at the bar for a while, come back, bring some with you, you know, and pretty much get drunk all night while the computer ran itself. They just fired me. They told me don't come in that shape anymore, and I did, and they fired me. And second place put me in a facility. And I was about to go in, and my father called me into his bedroom. My father, he's a mute. He doesn't say anything unless he's yelling at you, unless he's angry, you know. And he called me into his. It's cool. You got a timer right here. It's really good. I'm looking over there. There's a timer right here. So my dad calls me in, right? And he's like, I'm easily distracted. All right, come on, you all laugh. Audience participation time. So, what time do I have to stop? Good? I'm good. Okay. So, talk amongst yourself. So, my dad calls me in, and he says, you know, he says, I doubled my life insurance policy on you. He said, I'm preparing for my oldest son to die. And he said, you're killing me, you're killing your mother, and you're killing this family. And he said, you're 105 pounds, soaking wet. You got a great complexion. He said, you look like you're walking dead. And, you know, I said, Dad, I got this. Yeah, and I walked out. And, I mean, a couple of days later, I went into my first facility. And when I got out, I was in there 3 months. And this is back in the day when they put you away for 3 months and the insurance paid for it. And I was in there for 3 months. I got out on a Wednesday. I stayed in my house till Friday night. Friday night, I was on my way to the first meeting and never made it there. I think I was out of my house 20 minutes before I relapsed. And went back to the facility because I was doing outpatient, that whole thing. And they gave me, the guy says, you gotta go back in. And I'm like, I got Bruce Springsteen concerts coming up for the whole next month. It was the Born in the USA tour. It was the beginning of the Born in the USA tour. I'm sorry, Alcoholics Anonymous has no affiliation with Bruce Springsteen. The rules. I'm being retaped, no less. So I wouldn't go. I wouldn't go in. And he gave me his car, and he said, "You're gonna need this, you know." And in a month, I needed it. I lasted like a month. Like I said to myself, you know what? I'm just not gonna do it like before work, and, you know. And sure enough, within a month, I was drunk on my way to work, and I called them, and they put me in another facility for another 3 months. And I was a little bit more humble because I kind of knew, like the first time I left, thinking, all I got to do is not pick up a drink, right? Not pick up a drink. I know that's not going to sound funny on tape, but it was. We need the video. The video would be with it. So anyway, my second rehab, I kind of was really nervous, and I was a little bit more humble, and I was willing to listen. And the first rehab, like I said, they told me, "You're not going to make it." When I left, you know, I said, "You're not going to make it," because I'm thinking I could hang with my friends, I could do the same things I was doing, you know. And I got my ego. My first thing that came back was my ego. I mean, right? 17 years, of active alcoholism. All of a sudden, you put me away for 3 months and feed me and let me sleep and let me work out. I felt like a champ. I haven't felt like that in ages. I was ready to take on the world for like 20 minutes. and so then I go in my next facility and much more humble. I come out and I come out with a plan that if I drink once every 90 days, just for today, I could have a drink and I won't go on a bender, right? And I won't and I kind of put that plan into it. Kind of, I got drunk once. I got drunk another time 90 days later. The third time I was in a rehab again. And it's weird because you read the book, and later on I read the book like a novel then. And I did go through, I did have a sponsor, and he took me through the workbook. And it was an experience at that point, and it was, I understood what I was doing, but I didn't understand the depth and weight of what I was doing, if you know what I mean. Like, I did my first 7-step, and I asked God to remove the shortcomings. And then, walked out of there going, I can't steal. I can't cheat. I can't lie. And I was I was still acting a fool and trying to run the recovery program because I was trying to kind of do what I was told, but I wasn't really ready to live what I was talking about at that point. And you come in here brand new off the street, and all of a sudden you hear all these new words, acceptance, willingness. They were never in my vocabulary before. Humility, gratitude, So I kind of was going through the motions, but I was trying to still be a weasel, And one thing I really learned through the years is for any of you that are in here and fronting or trying and half measures avail us nothing. And to me, what that really means down here in my gut is I need to give myself a chance to not feel like a dirtbag. Because you can get away with whatever you want to get away with, but at the end of the day, when you put your head on the pillow, you know what you did. You know what I mean? So no matter how many meetings you go to, no matter how many steps you work, if you're still acting like a dirtbag, at the end of the day when you go to sleep, you don't know what it's like to put your head on a pillow and having that inventory be clear. Having that, going to the right, okay, this is, I'm clear. I didn't hurt anybody today. I had no resentments today. I had no anger today. And to know what it's like to feel like that. And because that's what recovery is about for me. That's what recovery has become about for me. Not so much about, obviously it was about not getting arrested and not getting drunk and not destroying my life and everyone around me. That was the beginning of it. But then, then I suffered from untreated alcoholism for a long time and had to learn how to, be at peace with who the hell I was. Because I was a mess. I came in a hot mess. And I'm like, okay. And everything I did in my life up to the point I came in here was really crooked and crazy. And I had to back into what I'm still trying to back into normal. It's 27 years later. I'm not sure what normal is, but I figured out what typical is, And if I could try and stay somewhere typical, I know I'm not going to probably hurt anybody today. And that's where I'm going to. That's my I'm on a daily basis. That's my plan. So anyway, it took me three facilities. When I got into my third facility, Bruce Springsteen had finally finished the Born in the USA tour, and believe it or not, my last run, coincidence would have it, my last run was the last 10 days at the Born in the USA tour at Giant Stadium, and that's fate would have it. And the day after, I was already scheduled to go in. Like, I was on the run, and I wasn't stopping until after the concerts were over. And I went in the next day. And then I got there, you know, and it was like I had done it for most of the year. And it was like, you know, just a couple of times when I had this stupid little plan, and I said, F it, you know, I'm going to do what I want, you know, instead of just listening to what everybody was telling me. And if you read the chapter more about alcoholism, tells them we're going to try every way possible to prove that we're not like alcoholics, right? Therefore, we don't have to work the 12 steps, have spiritual awakening, work with other people, have prayer and meditation, do inventory, right? That's what it comes down to, basically. If you're an alcoholic, is there any moderate drinkers in the house tonight? We're on tape. No, right? You're all laughing at me. All right. So if you're a real alcoholic like I am, then the truth is that no human power can help me, and that what I needed to do, and I needed to understand that, you know, my understanding of what could help me, right? Not someone else's. You know, if someone's trying to shove their version of God down your throat, find somebody else. That's my opinion based on experience. But people like that scare other people away, and when we scare other people away, that, you know, people die. One of the most important words in the Big Book was find the God of your understanding. Right? And so we're all able to do that, whatever it means to you. You know, a power that was sufficient enough to change our way of thinking so that we could recover from alcoholism. And for me, it's a lot of different things, and it continues to change and it continues to evolve. So I don't doubt when somebody's had greater experiences than I have. I wish that I've had them. I often wonder, am I doing what he does? A great teacher of mine, you know, talked about some great experiences that he had. He meditates half hour a day, three times a day. I don't have time to do that. I meditate in the morning, I meditate in the evening, and if I get a half hour, I'm really blessed, but it's usually more like 10 to 15, 20 minutes. And if you're a nut like me, it usually takes about 9.5 for my brain to slow down. So I get a good half minute of serenity, silence, and, you know, oneness with my Creator, you know. And that, unfortunately, that's where we shortchange ourselves, you know. And I know it. Yet reality in my life is, you know, we're running around, you know, we're working, we're trying to have relationships, we're trying to take care of kids and family and food and sickness and wellness, and, you know. But that half hour of devotion lets us do all that stuff. Let's just be spiritually centered to all that stuff. I know I'm going back and forth and stuff. I hope you all... Is there anybody really, like, neurotic about me being in order with what happened and what it was like and what's going to happen, what happened now? Because I'm going to go back and forth. You know, just stick with me. Let me know where I'm at. If I forget, I'm going to ask you. My daughter suffers from this disease. And 2 years ago, in the holidays, I got a call from Florida. I got a call from a bell bondsman that she was in jail in Florida, and it was like 2 days before Christmas. And I said, "Tell her I love her. I can't get her out, you know." And I got like three more calls from three more different bell bondsmen, and I left her. And this guy that I'm talking about is just a great example of what this program can do, and if you're willing to put yourself that much into it. I went to see him. He was doing a workshop. And we know each other well. He's my grand sponsor. He sponsors my sponsor. And he looked at me and he said, "Are you all right?" He goes, "You look like something rocked your world." You know, and I said, "My daughter," he told him, "you know, my daughter's in jail. She busted out of rehab. She's on the streets, and she got busted. She's in jail." And he says, "How many people do you sponsor right now?" I was working with about five people where I was just about every night of the week, I was meeting with someone at my house, taking them through the work. And And he said, "You need to." He goes, "You need to do an inventory tonight. your fears and your resentments attached to this, and he goes, and you need to stay in prayer and meditation longer because you need to be spiritually centered because you got other people's lives in your hands. He says you're meeting with people every day who are counting on you being spiritually centered." And he said, "And your daughter's going to need you to be spiritually centered. She'll make the right decisions. You're going to have to make tough decisions." You know, and how beautiful, and that might, how beautiful is that? Because, you know, it, coming from the point where we used to come into a meeting and raise our hand and whine, right, and somebody would just listen to us whine, when someone would say, "You need to go home and get right because you're working with people who are counting on you of being right." How beautiful. You know, and I did. And within like 2 days, like I knew I was doing the right thing to start with, but it was hard for me to stomach because I knew if my parents did that for me, I would want to strangle them. You know, when I was active, if my parents left me in there over the holidays, I wouldn't want to strangle them. And now here I'm doing it to my daughter. And you can strangle me all you want, and at least I know you're still alive. You know, and she's still alive today. She celebrated a year in August, so she's whatever somewhere around a year and a half. And she's back to being beautiful and healthy and loving. And if you live long enough, you stay sober long enough, you know, you get to put your kids in rehab. We make a lot of connections in the rooms. we get the AA rate, you know, we get our kids in rehab and we get them well and we get them back, man. So anyway, back to my story. So out of the third rehab, I started working steps. I started going through, you know, the changes that we go through trying to learn how to act and trying to learn how to be a recovering human being, right? And I had recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body because I had no chance. I was dying. And not only that, but if you knew me then, I was hell on wheels. I mean, and Sarah's heard this. I don't know how many other people, but literally, when I got into my third rehab, right, within the first 3 days, they put me on blackout from women. They put me on blackout from sports. And they put me on blackout from my rock and roll clothes, right? And because I used to go to meetings, right? And I showed up at rehab, right, with spandex pants, black. This is 1985, right? With black spandex pants, like inside my boots were up to here, right? And I had like three belts that wrapped around like that, right? And I had nice shirts, like leopard stuff on it, right? And like leopard jacket, right? And I had like long hair with blonde streak over here and a feather earring, and I wore eyeliner, right? and I go to a meeting like that, and hang out like that. Like that was, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that. Everybody all got eyeliner on or anything. So it's all good, you know. At some point, you might feel like, you know, maybe you need to grow out of it. I used to go out like that at night, right? Go to the meetings, and then we go out dancing, you know, and do whatever we did in recovery, you know, trying to, you know, not go crazy, stay sober, and still have fun. And then I go to play softball on Sunday mornings, right? In a recovery league, and like the other guy come over to me, like the left fielder come over to me and go, "Dude, you still got makeup on." I got like my uniform on. I said, "I guess I still got my eyeliner on." Getting it off, I don't know how you girls do it. It's easier to put on and get off. Anyway, how did they give that stuff up? But you know, these are the changes that you go through in recovery, right? Like I did this stuff like without the use of alcohol, you know. And it's funny because like, I never would have done that under the influence, you know, but that's really what happened. Really what happened was once I started to become sober, I started to really just become who I was, which was really just a silly dude who really didn't care much and liked to have fun, you know what I mean? And like a lot of that stuff was always balled up inside because I was always worried about what y'all thought, you know? So like I was always, because it started out like that for me. Like I was like 4'11", 76 pounds. I reached puberty when I was like 17. You know what I mean? So like when I was really young, I mean, you know, like I was just doing everything I could to fit in with everybody. You know what I mean? And whatever, like I got an earring, I got tattoos, I got whatever, you know. And my father would always freak out. What does this mean? I go, Hopefully it means I got a date, you know. And then, like, I walked into like, high school. Like, the first time I walked into high school, and I'm a freshman, and I'm literally this big, right? I'm like, I got a squeaky voice, right? And this big old dude with, like, he was a senior with long hair. This was when they was hippies, too. Like the dude over there. I saw you, right? It might have been you, dude. I kind of looked just like him. long hair and a beard and stuff. He goes, I'm dating myself here. He goes, want to buy a draft card? like draft cards, for those of you who are young, right? Like, that used to be a form of ID, like, you could use with, like, a driver's license. And, like, I could have had a draft card, my birth certificate, driver's license, and my mother sitting next to me. Nobody was serving me. I looked like I was 12. You know what I mean? Anyway, so where was I? Back in my third rehab? I'm my third rehab, and I'm in recovery, and I'm going through this process. And I'm going through this process for a number of years. Got married in recovery. Lost a job in recovery. Lost a career job in recovery. Lost my wife in recovery. And what I found out is that we as alcoholics are very resourceful when it comes to finding new and interesting ways to mess up our lives. You know, it does. Like we learn a lesson. Oh, I'm never going to do that again. But we're going to find something new tomorrow that we never even thought of and mess up our lives again today. You know, and it just seemed to be like that was the story. Like I knew everything I couldn't do anymore. You know, and then like I, oh, oops. You know, and I do something else. And so, yeah. Really, what I found out later was I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. I mean, I got in, you know, in the rooms, and you're in here 10 years and you're 15 years and you get married and you have a kid, and then all of a sudden you start go to a meeting a month, not really working with anybody. Then my sponsor died. I didn't get another one. You know, so now I'm like in this void where I'm really not connected to a fellowship. I'm really not working on any steps. You know, I'm really not sponsoring anybody. And the program tells us this is what we have to do to stay sober. You know, if I took somebody through a fourth step 5 years ago, it wouldn't help me today. It does absolutely nothing for my spiritual condition today. It lets my ego BS you that I'm working with people, which just keeps me sick. Right? So, you know, what I had to really do was I started suffering and I started hurting. And I started, like, my anger, like, my character defects started coming back. And I started becoming violent. And I started, you know, being miserable. And I was just a grumpy, miserable, angry, like, waiting to explode. And I'm praying to God, like, asking Him to put somebody in my life as a sponsor and put somebody in my life as a sponsee. And thank God, God knows what he's doing. So he didn't give me a sponsee until he gave me a sponsor, you know. And obviously, no, I don't think any man, if you talk to me for 5 minutes, I don't think I didn't have anything to offer anybody. You know, I was literally going up to the podium once a year and getting my coin. So, you know, so I had a full collection. But, you know, I wasn't doing a whole lot. I wasn't giving a whole lot back to this fellowship at all. I was in a relationship at the time, and the girl came home with this guy's phone number and said, you should ask this guy to sponsor you. He's really good. And I got really pissed off. I said, don't ever come home with a guy's name to ask me to sponsor him. Right? I'll figure out who's going to sponsor me. But then I went to see him speak, and he was really serious, and he was dead on. And I was like, okay, you know, this guy scares me. Like, I was like 21 years sober, 20 years sober, whatever. It's like, do I really want to deal with this 20 years sober? You know, and what it was he treated this like it was a life and death disease, which it is. And I've gotten very comfortable and very complacent, right, and very cocky. and my ego was telling me that I wasn't going to drink and that I didn't have to worry about doing everything he wanted me to do. So I backed right off. And then I have an episode where I'm in a supermarket with this girlfriend, and she buys a bunch of produce and lettuce and tomatoes and fruit and strawberry. You all know what produce is, right? And so she goes through the self-checkout aisle, right? And I don't want her to go through the self-checkout aisle because I don't know how to do the self-checkout well, because to ask questions that says, is the turkey from Romania, or the lettuce from Romania, or is it from Bulgaria, or is it iceberg, or whatever. And she goes, I know how to do it. So, okay, she knows how to do it. So she starts ringing it up, her phone rings, and she walks out. And leaves me there with all the stuff. I don't know what I'm doing. So now I start slamming stuff. The tomatoes go all over the place. The bag rips, right? So I throw it on the floor, and I walk out. I said, go get your stuff. I go back in, and she goes, the guy won't give us new stuff, right? New produce. So I grab the stuff, and the checkout dude, who was 16, was like standing by the wall, and I just grabbed the whole bag, and I just smashed it up against the wall above his head, and broke all the stuff all over his head. At 21 years sober. All right. So I go to a meeting that night, and I'm talking to a respected member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 40-something years clean, sober. And he stays with me for like an hour after. We're walking up and down the boardwalk, and he says, did you want a drink? Do you want a drink? Do you want a drink? No, I want to kill people. He was pissing me off. He kept asking me if I wanted a drink. He understood that a drink was this far away from my hand. He saw that my defects had come back, that I was full rage, that I was, and I didn't want help. He wanted to help me. He was offering himself to help me, to take me through the steps, and I didn't want it. And he saw that I was this close to drinking, and I wasn't getting it. Right? So I go to, shortly after that, I go to a workshop, and I hear this guy speak. And he spoke like I never heard anybody speak before. And he talked about this fellowship and his program like I never heard anybody talk about it before. And I said, you know what, this... And I literally, it was a 12-week workshop. I was there every week. And I was sitting on the edge of my seat, and I was just looking at him, and I was listening, and I was so intent. He just had me. He was talking with depth and weight and a humbleness, but a definiteness, you know, like about this program. And it just was hitting me right in the gut, you know. And he got to the point where he was talking about page 52 and the bedevilments, you know. And he's like, he's saying, some of you, you know, with double-digit clean time and sober time might be sitting here. He goes, and you may be in this position. He said, and when I say this, he goes, you may get, you know, a little knot in your stomach. He goes, that's okay. He goes, that's just a little resistance. He goes, that's your ego fighting back. He goes, just go with it. He goes, you know, and go home. He goes, and sit with it and get still and get quiet. He goes, and see where you need to go. He goes, and he started reading the bedevilments. And he goes, are you prey to misery and depression? It was like, you know, you have a feeling you're useless. It was, you know, it was like, are you unhappy? You know, and it was like one after another, it was punching me in the stomach. And I was like, this dude just told me how I was going to feel when he told me how I was feeling. You know what I mean? It was like, and so I go, this is him, right? So I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, listen, can you help me? I need a sponsor. And he introduced me to the guy that I've been avoiding, that my girlfriend come home with the phone number, right? That I went to see. That said, this dude is way too serious. He said, he can help you. Right? And he brought me to him, you know. So I said, I mean, I've been around long enough to know God plays tricks on y'all. So I was like, okay, I guess it's my turn, you know. And I also know that he takes care of you. You know, that sometimes you got to go that extra mile in order to get that extra, you know, benefit. So I asked him to sponsor me. And he told me to get a brand new big book. And he said, get a pen, get a dictionary, get a marker. And he said, we're going to go through the big book like you're a newcomer, because you might as well be, you know. And we did the set-aside prayer, you know. And because my ego was really, I had resistance. You know, like he had a year less than me. I'm like, you know, you got a year less than me. Come on, dude. You know, and you know, he would tell me everything that was wrong with me, and I was like, all right. But you know, somewhere there's a beautiful thing that happens when you ask God. You sit down with another man, with another woman, if you're a woman, you know, and you invite God into that session every week or however often you meet. And this is a beautiful thing that happens, because you, God, and that person have an experience with the book. And so what happened was, all of a sudden, that ego disappeared. You know, all of a sudden I knew he was right. I knew what he was talking about was absolutely right. And he took me through the book and in a way that I had never been taken through before. And he highlighted all the things that kind of pulled the book together and made sense to me. You know, and so he took me through, you know, the right in the beginning, we put, you know, we did the triangle and the circle, you know, and then he broke down the chapters and where they all fit in and how they met, and, you know, about the doctor's opinion and the physical aspect of the disease, you know, and then more about alcoholism was the story of my life. It was literally the story of my life. I did everything in there. I tried to do it by self-knowledge. I tried to do, you know, and it tells us self-knowledge is not going to get you, right? The most powerful desire to stop drinking is not going to be enough. If you're an alcoholic of this variety, like I am, like you all say you all are, right? You know, then we, like, no human power. Nothing short of a spiritual experience. And half measures will get us nowhere. And then in there is a solution. I hate quoting stuff on tape, but that I'm going to be wrong. I think it's in there. It's a solution. It's just, the great fact is this and nothing less that each and every one of us has deep and effective spiritual experiences, right? And right underneath there, it talks about anything. He had me write in anything short of a spiritual experience. Right, it's a middle of the road solution, and no middle of the road solution will do. You know, and it was weird. I unlearned a lot of things that I had learned through the years that, like, a lot of us just mouth, like, you know, God's in the coffee pot. You know, God's not in the coffee pot. Coffee's in the coffee pot, right? But if you come early and make it, you might find a sponsor that'll take you through the steps and you might wind up meeting God, you know? And, like, you know, take commitments, you know, take commitments that'll keep you sober. Commitments don't really keep you sober. They keep you coming to a meeting, so hopefully you find a sponsor who will take you through the work, through the 12 steps, how to have a spiritual experience so you can sponsor other people and stay sober. And I got that right, I think, in order. And so, like, these were lessons that I kind of had to unlearn and then relearn. You know, and a lot of the stuff that we learn through the years that we just keep mouthing, you know, and we don't even know what it means. I said, turn it over. What does turn it over mean to somebody who just walked in? Or, you know, like what they told me. I was sitting in the room the first year. I was holding on to my seat like this, and I was telling people, I want to go. Like, I'm going. After the meeting, I'm money in my pocket and I'm going. And, like, there were people love me, talk to me about myself. They would take me to a diner and they would sit with me till 11:30, 12, because I was tired enough that I wasn't going to go that night. And I went home, you know. And they would say, don't quit before the miracle happens. You know, finally, I was like, well, when is this miracle that you speak of going to happen? Tell me about it, you know. And what you know, and what they, no one was able to really give me an answer at that point in my recovery. But what I learned was it happens in the 10th step. Right? The problem will be removed as if it didn't exist. We'll be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We're not even fighting off or swearing. And that is so where I'm at and been at for so long that it's such a beautiful place to be that if I knew that coming in, I would have signed up for that in a minute. But I had no idea. To me, it was like you're taking away everything I know, and nobody was really telling me what it was about, what I was going to learn, where I was going to be, who I was going to become. I was scared. Everything I knew and everything I've ever done, they told me, well, you got to change everything. Oh, change it to what? Right? Nobody really knew that. So, okay, you're taking a guy who was a rock and roll drunk, wannabe, and now you want me to do what? Work steps. And have an experience with God and meet with newcomers every night. I was like, come on, really? And because having not experienced it in my life, contemporary investigation, right? How could that be interesting? God, what a beautiful life I've been given. God, what a beautiful life that I've been given. Because I really get to experience it. I get to understand what I'm experiencing. I get to understand what I don't want to experience before I experience it. You know, we learn so many lessons in recovery on how to have a beautiful life. That's really all it's about. That's what this is about. How to be comfortable, how to sit, how to be comfortable with serenity, how to not have drama in our life. We're so used to having drama. It's like, you know, if you don't have any drama in your life, you go look for somebody who does. Right? Make sure you call me. Call me. Call me every day. Right? Because, you know, drama shared, right? You know. But, you know, now it's like, you know, I remember when, you know, you read the book, right? And different times at different things, it's like songs, you know. When you're falling in love, a song sounds one way. But when you're breaking up, the same song sounds completely different, you know, right? It's the same song, but it's like you're hearing it way different. And it's like, you know, like it's like when you go to a meeting and you really messed up. Whatever meeting you're going to, I was like, this is right what I needed to hear. You know, because that's what you really needed to hear. Your vibration is looking for something like that. You know, and we turn it into what we needed to be. And, you know, you go, oh, I needed to. Thank God it was a seven-step meeting. It was right where I'm at because my defects have been, you know. And if it was a third-step meeting, we'd have said the same thing. You would have said the same thing. You needed to be where you were at because you needed to be somewhere where God was and other recovering alcoholics, right, who could tell you the truth about yourself because they love you. So I got to go through the steps again. I had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. I'll tell you a couple of nice stories that happened as a result of my sponsor being very spiritually aware, which is a very important part of this process. I had somebody who was on my resentment inventory, somebody who I gave a job to, I gave another job to. He worked in two separate places, one that I was a general manager at and one I owned for me, stole from me in both places. I sponsored him for a number of years, and he went in and out, in and out. And the last time he went out, he basically barricaded up his house, and his wife called me and said, can you go down to the house? And I hadn't seen him in a few months, so I knew what happened and where he went. And I showed up at his house. I said, hey, I just was driving by, how you doing? And he's like, oh, Mr. AA, what are you doing here? Really, you just happened to stop by, huh? You know, he's giving me the whole drunk, you know, ready to punch me in the face. You know, really, don't come here because, you know, I really like you and I don't want to have to hit you. You know, I'm like, all right. His wife just asked me to come by and see if you are right, you know. And so he went on my resentment inventory. I showed him. So you know, he's on my resentment inventory, right? And my sponsor puts him on my harm inventory. He said, I owe him amends. Well, what do I owe him amends for? I said, I was trying to help out his wife. I was doing a thing, you know. I helped him. I took him through the work. I gave him jobs, and he treated me like that. He said, you had expectations. I hated that word. It was a new word I learned. And then every time there was a resentment, it was something that Jimmy felt I needed to make right. It was because of my expectations. And he said, you work with somebody because you work with somebody. Because you're doing God's work, not because you expect a certain outcome or him to act a certain way. So like, all right, whatever. So I call him to make the amends, you know, and he's like, what? And I was like, listen, I said, I've been pissed off at you for a year now because of what happened and the way you treated me. And he's like, dude, listen, he goes, I just got out of rehab this afternoon. And he said, and they took me through the big book. He goes, I never been taken through the book like that before. And he said, and I'm up to step four. And he goes, I need somebody to help me do a four step. And he goes, I need to know where they have meetings like this, and I need to know somebody who's been through the work like this. And I was like, I just finished going through the work. I go, I'll be at your house in 10 minutes. I was on my way home from work. I said, I'll be at your house in 10 minutes. I'll pick you up. We'll go to the diner. I picked him up. We'll go to the diner. We started his fourth step that night. Sometimes when we make amends, we don't necessarily know why until later. You know, but we make ourselves more available. That's why a lot of times we don't, you know, it says we don't put ourselves in a position where we can't be of help at a later date. You know, we never quite know why we're going to be doing something. And we go do it, and God has a plan that you didn't know about. You know? I'll tell another story where later on I was speaking. It was kind of a meeting similar to this, and I was speaking for, you know, it was me for an hour. And this guy was in the front, like, where this gentleman is, right? And when I was talking about the 10-step promise, and I was saying that the problem will be relieved, you know, removed as if it didn't exist, and that we're in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, and the guy was, like, looking at me, shaking, right? And so after the meeting, you know, everybody was coming up, and everybody was, you know, shaking my hand and doing whatever, you know, nice, good job, whatever. And the dude came up and shook my hand, and he said, you looked right at me when you said that the problem would be removed as if it didn't exist. He goes, man, because I had shivers down my spine. All right. You know, and, you know, I kind of let him go, and I kept shaking hands, and I kept on the line, you know. And I forget I forgot for a minute why we do this, you know. I was getting caught up in all the shaking everybody's hand. The reason we do this is to help the alcoholic who needs help. And there was somebody who was presenting himself to me, and I wasn't being aware enough to catch it. So I go to the workshop with the same teacher, doing another workshop. And at the end of the session, he has a question and answer session for 15 minutes. And this guy stands up and he says, "Nobody around my area will sponsor me until after I have 90 days." He goes, "And I'm going to be dead by the time I have 90 days." And the guy, he's my grand sponsor, right? So after the meeting, he takes him and he brings him over to me and he goes, "Mike will help you." Right? So it's like, you know what? It's like, you know, God can't be denied, right? His fellowship. You can let it go by you, and he'd bring them right back around. This one's yours, you know? And I sat down with the dude after the meeting, right? And he was like, "I knew it." He goes, "I knew when you were looking at me." He goes, "I knew it." You know what? And we stand up here to help people. We stand up here to touch people. That's what we do. I say a prayer before I stop. Put the words in my mouth that somebody needs to hear. Right? Let something in me touch something in them. And that's all you can do when you're up here. And you know what? When it does, and there's a connection, we need to honor that. We need to honor that because we live on a daily basis by taking people through the work. You know, if you haven't done all 12, please do. And I don't like, as you could tell, because there's 7 minutes left. And I don't like to take us through one by one, because it just gets too boring for me. So hopefully I've talked enough about recovery and enough about what it was like and enough about what it was like now. And I kind of bounced around a lot. And I introduced the story and I introduced those steps. But I don't like to go in a regimented order because it would bore me. And it would bore me if I was there. So I kind of bounce around. I don't plan what I say. I say, "God, please put the words in my mouth." I come up here, I start talking. So you got to resent it. Put it on God. Blame it on God. But it's going to be passing the buck, right? I'm taking the last. what winds up happening as a result, right? What happens is you speak, and then people ask you to speak again. Somebody hears you say, "Can you speak in my home group?" Sure. And then you speak some more, and then you touch someone when you're speaking, and they ask you to sponsor them. And then you touch someone when you speak somewhere else, and they ask you to sponsor them. And then before you know it, you know, like it steamrolls, and like you live in the recovery life, and it's like, you know, it's a beautiful thing. You meet, and because it, again, like I said, if you didn't work all 12, please do. And if you haven't been on the other side, like if you're not on the other side of like adhering a fourth step, you got to complete your recovery. You got to, because what that does, I mean, you get to feel God working through you. Because I'm not all that good. You know what I mean? I'm going to put in the time. I'm going to pray. I'm going to get quiet before somebody comes over. And somebody comes over with their fourth step. And you know, like the book says, we go on a hunch. We've come to rely on it. You know, that it's not a hunch anymore. That it's God nudging us. You know, and you say, "Okay, you know, what'd you forget? Give me the 3 things that you didn't put on there." You know, and 3 things come out. Right, before we even start. Now you got the worst 3 out of the way. Everything's downhill from there, right? You know, so then you share a little bit with them. You make them comfortable. And then boom, and we move on, you know? Or you start seeing the pattern and you say, "This is what I'm seeing," right? And tears and like a whole lifetime full of mess. Like you just present it back to them. And it's not because you got a degree and it's not because you're that smart. It's because God's working through you. And you asked him in the beginning of the session to please work through me. And he did. You know, and then when the people go, I always thank God again, you know, because it what a beautiful gift. And if you're missing out on that, I mean, that's for me is I was working with people literally five to six nights a week. And I had to step back. What happened to me recently was I got sick and I had something where I needed to take better care of myself. I needed to shop for groceries and prepare food properly. And I stepped back from working with people, and I stepped back from speaking, and I kind of spent more time with my kids and more time with my family and more time just being healthy and getting healthy again. And, you know, now I need to find the balance, you know, and because that's what we do. You know, that's what we do. We all of a sudden we're like, recovery 17 days a week, you know, all night, every night, you know. And then it's like, wait a minute, I got to, eat vegetables 17 days a week. You know, where do I go to meetings? There's no carrots in my meetings, you know. And I gotta find a meeting with carrots, you know what I mean? And go to a meeting near the farmer's produce market, and, you know. And so I gotta kind of find the middle ground, the happy ground, the happy medium. You know, in the beginning, in the book, Bill said, and I'm gonna close on these two things with Bill. When Bill was struggling, he used to go to that. This is before anyone else got sober beside Bill. And he was struggling, having a bad day. He would go to the hospital and talk to other drunks. What's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous 75 years later, and not necessarily in a solution-based group like this, but in a lot of groups, what's happened is when you're struggling, you go ask for help. You don't go try and help somebody else. You go ask for help and attention. You know, I had a really bad day, and you know, you call your sponsor and ask him to help you. You call your network and ask them to, and they're all helping you. But if you got out of yourself and tried to help someone else that moment, that night, let me go try and help somebody else, and you get yourself, you forget that your problem, what your problem is, because if you're sober today, your problem is not that bad. Your problem is a luxury problem at this point. Not that we all don't have real life. I've had life hit me upside the head in every different way since I've been in recovery. But I deal with it a lot more different today. You know, I had to learn how to become an adult sober male and who I wanted to present myself as an adult sober male. And it was a different person that came in the rooms in my Duran Duran clothes. they still call me Rockstar Mike. I still kind of dress a little funky, but... Sarah made me wear a suit. you know, Bill talked about the alcoholic is in a cave. Right? And outside the cave is his family, the priest, you know, the therapist. And they beckon the alcoholic to come out. Right? But he won't. And they can't go in and get him. And it said that the true alcoholic, right, armed with the fact about himself, can re-enter the cave by memory and lead the alcoholic out by hand. Hopefully I've done a little bit of that tonight. Thanks for listening.